Natagoti Vaishnavinda Kija, Namachari Shuharidas Thakura Kija. Prem Shikaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gadadhar Shri Vasa Nigora Bhakta Vinda Kija. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gogopina Shai Mukunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan Kija. Vrindavan Dham Kija, Mathura Dham Kija, Navajit Mayapur Dham Kija, Jagannath Puri Dham Kija. Gangamay Juna Devi Kija, Bhakti Devi Kija, Tulsi Maharani Kija. Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda Kija, Goa Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. Nityananda Kija. Nama Om Vishnu Vadaya Krishna Sambhadalashin Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namani Namaste Saraswati Devan. Gauravani Pachani Nirvasesa Sanivani Paskachade Satani. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Utapad Kamalam Sri Guru Om Vaishnavas Chal Sri Guru Tham Sangujatam Sadhina Raghunatham Vitam Stam Sajivam. Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam. Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sagana Lavata Sri Vishakam Vitam Stam. Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jai Advaita
Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda.
Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jai Advaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda.
Jai Advaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda.
Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jai Advaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda.
Jai Advaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda.
So it's February 9th, 2017 in Brisbane, Australia. We're reading from Anchalila, the Chaitanya Charitamrita, on this day of the appearance of Lord Nityananda. Reading from chapter 12. So we'll just go through the translations. Starting with text 1. O devotees, may the transcendental life and characteristics of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu always be heard, chanted, and meditated upon with great happiness. All glories to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is all merciful. All glories to Nityananda Prabhu, who is an ocean of mercy. All glories to Advaita Acharya, who is also an ocean of mercy. All glories to all the devotees of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, whose hearts are always filled with mercy. The Krishna Das Kaviraj was really in a celebrating mercy mood. The mind of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was always morose because of a constantly manifest feeling of separation from Krishna. So we may say spiritual life is joyful, where you have the topmost epitome of spiritual life, always feeling morose and separation. So beyond the mode of goodness, beyond the Brahman, beyond Santaras. Santaras means peaceful ras. There are these waves of emotion and higher levels of bhakti ras. And this so-called moroseness is actually a kind of ecstasy. It's a variety of ecstasy. So I give the example all the time that people like to see sad movies, isn't it? Right? Somebody will say, was it a good movie? Oh, it was a great movie. People can enjoy sadness. It's one of the rasas. Also pleasurable. Okay, going on, text 5. The Lord would cry, "Oh, my Lord Krishna, my life and soul, oh son of Maharajananda, where shall I go? Where shall I attain you? O Supreme Personality, who play with your flute to your mouth." This was his situation day and night. Unable to find peace of mind, he passed his nights with great difficulty in the company of Swarup Damodar and Ramananda Roy. Again, this is swasti nahi mane. Swasti actually means like auspiciousness. Literally. Not literally peace. No Prabhupada's translating it, peace of mind. So it's interesting because, again, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says you can't have happiness without peace. And the whole basis for all the forms of yoga is to attain peace of mind. And after you attain peace of mind, attaining peace of mind makes you detached from the material world, And after you attain peace of mind, you can attain transcendence. But when you attain transcendence in bhakti, you lose your peace of mind. Because it's like the upside-down banyan tree. What's low here is high there. And none of us really want just peace of mind as a permanent situation. Isn't it? Just peace. I am so peaceful. I mean, who wants to stay there? Maybe if you've had a hard day, you know, you just go in the ocean. Be peaceful. But we want extreme emotion. Recently in America, they had the Super Bowl, their big American football playoff. And people get very emotional, isn't it? And I might have mentioned how I was at the devotee's house where their son was watching some sporting game on television. He was yelling at the time. He was jumping up and waving his fist at the television. So people, why do they do these sporting events? As an excuse to be emotional, really. That's the only reason they do it. So ultimately, we want to have strong emotions. But materially, our strong emotions cause us nothing but trouble. So for the material emotions, we need to become peaceful and equipoised. From that platform, we can start to experience the spiritual emotions. Meanwhile, all the devotees journeyed from their homes in Bengal to see Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So you want to kind of keep in mind that he's in Jagannath Puri, Lord Chaitanya. This is the end of his pastimes of Lord Chaitanya in Jagannath Puri. Day and night, he's in separation. Then the devotees come from Bengal. And you'll notice when the Bengali devotees are there, Lord Chaitanya's days change. Headed by Shivananda Sen, Advaita Acharya, and others, all the devotees assembled in Navadvip. Okay, so you got that picture? Everybody assembles in Navadvip to go to Jagannath Puri, and the leaders are? Advaita Acharya and Shivananda Sen. So I'd like us to try to not just hear as this is what we're supposed to do in the morning, we're supposed to hear. Not like that, but to be a part of it, to actually imagine that we're there. We're gathering with the devotees. Advaita Acharya is there. He must be very elderly by now. And Shivananda Sen, and they're going to lead us all on a walking trip from Navadvip to Jagannath Puri. A long walk. I wonder if they had some carts with them. I don't know. I didn't mention carts. The inhabitants of Kulini Gram and Kanda village also assembled at Navadvip. So they've got other people coming from other places. And I'm sure the devotees there know them, you know, so there's some greeting going on, right? Oh, how are you? Haven't seen you since we went to Jagannath Puri last year. How are you doing? Because Nityananda Prabhu was preaching in Bengal, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had ordered him not to come to Jagannath Puri. That year, however, he went with the rest of the party to see the Lord. So this comes up later in the chapter. Srivas Thakur was also there with his three brothers and his wife, Malini. Acharyaratna was similarly accompanied by his wife. The wife of Shivananda Sen also came, along with their three sons. Raghava Pandi joined them, carrying his famous bags of food. So this was a family trip. I'm sure there were also renunciates there, but this was mostly a family trip. So the husbands and wives and children were all journeying to Jagannath Puri. And then Raghava Pandi has his famous bags of food, which are talked about elsewhere in Chaitanya Charitamrita. So they were all travel foods, because they would have to keep on the long journey and then be given to Lord Chaitanya. Vasudev Dutt, Murari Gupta, Vijayanidhi, and many other devotees went to see Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. All together they numbered 200 or 300. The devotees first saw Sachimata and took her permission. I was thinking, it's interesting that she doesn't go, but she stays in Navadvip. And of course, she would have been very elderly at the time. But there's no record of her ever going with this group to Jagannath Puri. She just gives her permission. Then in great happiness, they started for Jagannath Puri, congregationally chanting the holy name of the Lord. So this, they're having like a padayatra, basically, where they're doing kirtan on the way. So everybody's walking. Again, I don't know if there's any carts. And they're all singing. One would assume that there were some kind of carts, maybe small carts for carrying things. Shivananda Sen managed the payment of tolls at different places, maintaining everyone. He guided all the devotees in great happiness. Purport. Gati refers to the different toll booths used by the zamindars to collect taxes in each state. Generally, this tax was collected to maintain the roads governed by the various zamindars. Since the devotees from Bengal were going to Jagannath Puri, they had to pass through many such toll roads, and Sivananda Sen was in charge of paying the tolls. Okay, so we have this course today also where there's toll roads used to maintain the roads. Sivananda Sen took care of everyone and gave each devotee places to stay. He knew all the paths leading to Orissa. Okay, so this was, he was in charge of the party, and he was the front man. So he was in charge of arranging the places to stay and paying the tolls for these 200 or 300 devotees. Okay, that's clear to everybody? So he knew all the paths, he knew everything, everyone, just like, you know, when we do, when there's a big yatra someplace, and someone's in charge, and there's a person, lead person, who's in charge of everything. I don't know if any of you saw, there was a video, it was made by non-devotees, that was on the National Geographic channel, of the yatra that goes to Vrindavan, of Radhanaswami, disciples and followers, that's organized out of Mumbai. And what they do is they actually bring a mobile kitchen from Mumbai to Vrindavan. You know, a lot of the brahmacharis in the ashram in Chaupati are IT specialists and engineers. So all these, you know, engineer monks. And they do this amazing mobile kitchen that they set up. Now, in their case, that's thousands. They're actually feeding thousands, 5,000 to 8,000 devotees. So that's how they do it. But they have a hub. They have two hubs. So they set up a kitchen at their hub, and then they just go travel from there and go back to the kitchen, and there's one time they move the kitchen. It's like if any of you go on the Poland tour, there's a hub at a school, and then for Woodstock, they move to another hub, and then they move back to their original hub. But what this journey is about, that's being described here, is much more like the Padayatra, where you're moving from one place to another, and you're not bringing a kitchen with you. So you're having to find accommodations and food at each of the places that you go. And you can imagine to arrange accommodation for 200 to 300 people and arrange food for everybody. And of course, there's no question of mobile phones or internet. So, you know, it's not like you have everything just arranged in advance. I haven't been on Padayatra, but devotees who go tell me that at least in the early Padayatras, I don't know if it's still like that, but in the early ones, it was arranged what we would call on the fly. You know, that you wouldn't know until you got someplace. Sitala was telling me, Harisari's wife, how she went on, I think, the first Padayatra like that in the Vrindavan area, and they never knew where they were going to stay, what they were going to eat, how they were going to get drinking water, how they were going to do their laundry. I mean, they had no idea. It was really in the depend on Krishna mode. So Sivananda Sen was arranging it as they went, but Sivananda Sen did this every year. And so he had contacts everywhere. He had various contacts in each place. And if you're in a society where people can't communicate with each other long distance very easily, then people are accustomed to the atiti, the uninvited guest. You know, today if you're an atiti, we go, why didn't you call first? But in those days it wasn't like that. And so people had, the mood of people was that, oh, an uninvited guest is treated like God. Yeah, you can understand an uninvited guest would be burdensome, right? So there was the mood, because people couldn't be invited guests so easily all the time. It wasn't possible in that society. So people had the mood to treat the uninvited guest, specifically the uninvited guest, atiti. They don't have atiti, they don't have a time to come like God. So this was the mood in the society. But Sivananda Sen was the one who knew everyone, and he was the one who arranged it. And evidently nobody else took the initiative to arrange things. It all went through him. You know, we find that when we're traveling, that in some places, not all, but in some places, the local authority is very particular that they're the only ones who can arrange things. Right? Sometimes it's like that. You have to work through one particular person. And if you don't work through that person, things don't go smoothly. So, for whatever reason, Sivananda Sen was that person, and there wasn't anybody else who took any initiative to do things, although I'm sure many of these devotees traveled every year. Okay, one day when the party was being checked by a toll collector, the devotees were allowed to pass, and Sivananda Sen remained behind alone to pay the taxes. So evidently, usually, everybody would be stopped until Sivananda Sen paid, and then they'd all go together. In this case, the toll keeper said, well, you're taking care of everybody, you stay, and we'll let them all go. But there was a problem when that happened. The party went into a village, text 18, and waited beneath a tree because no one but Shiva Nanda Sen could arrange for their residential quarters. So they go on further into the village. Shiva Nanda Sen is detained there for a long time, paying tolls for 200 to 300 people and sorting everything out. And as you know, sometimes sorting these things out with government officials can take a long time. Right? I know at airports sometimes you can be in an immigration line for an hour and a half or 2 hours or something. One of my visits to Australia, when I came here with my oldest grandson, Janu, so we were in the immigration line for over an hour, and then we were in the agricultural line for an hour and a half. Because we have wooden beads, so because we have wood, we always have to go through the agricultural line. So then it was, you know, like 2.5-3 hours before, between the time we landed and the time we could leave the airport. So sometimes there's a long delay. Now, it says nobody else but Shiva Nanda Sen could arrange for that. So the reason isn't given, but somehow or other, maybe this was a particular village where he was the only one who knew people or whatever. Nobody felt that they could take the initiative to arrange something. Nityananda Prabhu, meanwhile, became very hungry and upset. Because he had not yet obtained a suitable residence, he began calling Shiva Nanda Sen ill names. Now, this particular verse is very strange. Several strange things going on here. Nityananda is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So first of all, he becomes hungry. How can God be hungry? Is that possible, ontologically speaking? Is it possible for God to be hungry? He is everything. Everything is within him. Everything it is. He can't be hungry. He's already eating everything. He already is everything. There's no question of him being hungry. And then generally, when we're hungry, we're not so polite. You know, when you deal with children, so I've spent the bulk of my life dealing with children, and if children behave uncharacteristically naughty, if a child who's normally well-behaved starts really being a problem, or if a child who's normally a problem becomes much more of a problem, if the child is uncharacteristically more of a problem than they usually are, the first thing you look at is, are they hungry? Are they tired? Are they sick? Then the next thing you look at is, was there some emotional disturbance? Did their parents have a fight that morning? You know, you look for those kind of things immediately, or you should. If when the child is uncharacteristically ill-behaved, you get heavy on the child, you're probably wrong. And, you know, I found this out the hard way many times. And after a while, I thought, okay, you know, when a child is uncharacteristically ill-behaved, never get on the case of the child at first. You know, always look for an underlying problem. And we have many instances in the Shastra where even great personalities become uncharacteristically angry and ill-behaved because they're disturbed in this way. So can you think of one of the stories of this?
Balaram with
Brahmaharshan. Well, that was from an insult.
Durvasa Muni
usually... Well, it is... sometimes there was one story with hunger with Durvasa Muni, where he wasn't getting fed on time. Yeah.
Damodar?
Oh, Krishna himself as a baby. What's the whole basis of the Bhagavatam? Somebody got angry because he was hungry and thirsty. Pricket. Pricket's traveling, he's hungry and thirsty. He didn't bring his, you know, plastic bottle of spring water with him. He might have had a canteen, like some kind of canteen that got depleted. It said he was hungry, thirsty, and tired. And because he was hungry, thirsty, and tired, when Samakirishi didn't answer him, he jumped to the conclusion that Samakirishi was being disrespectful, which he wasn't, he was in trance, and he puts a snake around his neck. But it started because he was hungry, thirsty, and tired. So it's very typical if a person's hungry, thirsty, tired, or if they have something else going on in their life. So I'm right now dealing with a situation with some devotees who were insulting each other. And it was interesting that one of the devotees involved, the first one who actually started the insult, told me, "Oh, I wrote that text late at night when I was very tired." The second devotee, the one who really escalated the insults to atomic war level, and who's normally a very sober mediator of other people's problems, who is generally the voice of reason when other people lose it, told me, "Oh yeah, I had just been dealing with a really difficult situation in my local center, and all kinds of people causing problems, and I'd been in the mode of throwing people out, and also I'm going to have surgery in a couple days, and people have died from this surgery." I'm like, "Oh." So it's very typical that if we're hungry, thirsty, tired, if something else is going on in our life, or you brought up the idea of being insulted, if we feel that we're insulted, that's another big thing. But we're much more likely to feel insulted if we're hungry, thirsty, tired, or disturbed already. Right? If someone does something and we interpret that something as an insult, that kind of interpretation is much more likely to come if there's something else going on in our lives. If we're hungry, if we're thirsty, if we're tired, if there's something. But we don't expect this from God. In fact, we don't even expect this from the sadhakas in the Hare Krishna movement. We expect the other sadhakas in ISKCON to be above being influenced by hunger, thirst, and tiredness. We expect them to have proper etiquette in all circumstances. Yes? We don't expect ourselves to have proper etiquette in all circumstances, but we expect everybody else to. And we certainly expect this of liberated devotees who are above the modes of nature, and they're not supposed to be affected by these whips of hunger, thirst, and fatigue. And what to speak if we expect it from God. In fact, it's often said that because the liberated souls are free from such things, God has to be free. This is one of Srila Prabhupada's logical arguments he gives many, many times. He says God can't be influenced by the modes of nature when his pure devotees aren't. How could the devotees of someone be above it and they not be? Yet we see this behavior in Lord Nityananda. And up to the point that he starts calling Shivananda saying ill names. Doesn't say what ill names, but we could guess. Right? So, how is that happening? One of the main impetuses for my leaving the religion of my parents and looking elsewhere for God, I had been looking for God since I was as young as I can remember, quite literally. But I was looking for it within the faith of my family. And the main impetuses for me to look elsewhere was a conversation I had with my religious leaders, with rabbis at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, one of the leading Jewish theological seminaries in the world. And I brought up actually quite a similar situation as to what's being described here. So if any of you have any familiarity with the Bible and with Judeo-Christian history. So the Jews were slaves in Egypt. They were released from their slavery by Moses and by the 10 plagues, and they were traveling through the desert, probably the Sinai desert, to go to Israel. They traveled for 40 years. So as they were, which is an awfully long time if you look at the geographical situation, why it would take them that long. But anyway, at a certain point, they stopped. They stopped at a place in the Bible called Mount Sinai. And Moses goes up to the mountain to receive the law. So this was really the beginning of the Jewish scripture. So God personally was giving him the law for the Israelite people. And Moses was up there for quite some time. Now while he was up there, the people started worshiping a calf made of gold. They were imitating some of the demigod worship of the Egyptians, who they had lived with for a very long time. So meanwhile, Moses had gotten the Ten Commandments written on slabs of stone with the finger of God. You know, that God has a finger that can write on stone, that can chisel into stone. Just like we have Hiranyakashipu. In our mantra, we say his sharp nails chiseled into the stone-like chest of Hirani Kashipu. Hirani Kashipu's body had become as strong as stone by the benedictions of Lord Brahma. So anyway, Moses is carrying down these stone tablets with the Ten Commandments. And if you're familiar with the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, etc. And when he comes down, he sees that the Israelites are engaged in some sort of demigod revelry, which is an imitation of some sort of Egyptian ritual and is not part of their own teachings. It's not part of the instruction he's gotten from God. So he gets very angry, and in his anger, he breaks the two tablets of stone. And he goes back up the mountain, and God says to him, because you got angry and broke the stone, I will kill them all. And Moses says, don't do that. He said, you promised their ancestor, Abraham, that his descendants would be as numerous as the stars and the grains of sand. And God says, well, we'll start from you and your descendants. And Moses says, no, you can't do that. You made a promise to Abraham, and you have to keep it. And so then God says, yeah, you know, you're right. All right, I won't kill them. And he rewrote the Ten Commandments, and it was brought down again. So I went to the rabbis, and I said, this story doesn't make any sense. How is God losing his temper? You know, this is the behavior of humans. That a human feels insulted or whatever, you know, and God was in the mood of defending Moses. Moses was angry, okay, so I'm going to defend you. You know, this is the kind of behavior of humans. I'm angry, I'm going to kill all of you. Why would God behave like that? And then on top of that, how can Moses convince God that he's wrong? How can God ever be wrong? Why would God say, yeah, you're right, I shouldn't do that, I'll change my mind? You know, what kind of a God is this? Because in Judaism we were taught that God is impersonal. That to think about God having a form and a personality was considered the greatest possible offense. So I couldn't make any sense out of it at all. You know, how do you have this impersonal God? And then you have these very personal characteristics. And I got yelled at. They said, how dare you ask this question? You cannot ask such questions. This is an offensive question. And this particular story in the Bible is at the heart of the Judeo-Christian tradition. This receiving, Moses receiving the law on Mount Sinai from God is the essence of the Jewish tradition, just like we can say Pericet receiving the Bhagavatam is the essence of our tradition. So I thought, if they can't answer a question about that, then how am I going to find truth within this tradition? And here we're faced with something very similar. We're faced with that Lord Nityananda becomes angry, as would an ordinary conditioned soul when they're hungry. And not only does he become angry, but he starts insulting Shivananda, saying, who you could say was faultless? Now, you could say he wasn't faultless. You could say that as soon as he saw he was going to be detained. Of course, you never know how long you're going to be detained at these kind of things. You don't know. Is it going to be 10 minutes? Is it going to be 3 hours? But as soon as he saw that he was detained, perhaps he could have deputized somebody. Either deputize somebody to pay the tolls so he goes on and finds their accommodation, or deputize somebody to find the accommodation while he pays the tolls. So he could have made some adjustment, and so that everybody, all these 200 or 300 people, would not, which included children and so forth, would not just be waiting in a village for a very long time. And if you think about the time of the year when they're traveling, what time of year are they traveling? They stay in Jagannath Puri during the monsoon. So what time of year are they traveling?
May.
They're traveling in the hot season. So they're traveling in the, you know, the kind of weather we're going to get tomorrow here in Brisbane, where it's 40 degrees, you know, or 45 degrees. That's the kind of weather that they're traveling in. Okay. So then Lord Nityananda calls him ill names. So how can we explain this? Some thoughts about how we can explain this behavior of God?
And the first time it comes later on is a mercy.
Okay, but yes, Shivananda Sen takes it as mercy, and we're going to go to Shivananda Sen's position very soon. But how do we explain this ontologically in terms of tattva? How can we explain Lord Nityananda's behavior? And yes, related to Damodar, who breaks the pond. And you could say, well, Damodar is a little baby, but God's, you know, that doesn't really help the situation. Because again, he's not some conditioned soul, he's not a human conditioned soul. So some explanation.
Does he want to experience this relationship with his devotees?
Okay, that it's about relationship. And that's really the key here. That this is about relationship. In this world, when we become disturbed by things like hunger, thirst, and fatigue, it's because we're identifying with our body. Because the soul is not hungry, thirsty, or fatigued. So it's due to an illusion. We're identifying with our body, and we're thinking, if my body doesn't get what it needs to survive, I won't survive. When we react strongly because of insults, and there's some perceived insult here also, I wasn't taken care of by Shivananda Sen. Then it's because we're identifying with our mind, and we're thinking, if people don't treat me with respect, I mean, on a physiological level, we're thinking, if people don't treat me with respect, then I won't be able to maintain my status in my community, and if I can't maintain my status, I won't have access to all the resources I need to live. Because as social creatures, a lot of how we get, a lot of how we get our food and water and shelter and so forth is because of the certain status we have in our social group. Does that clear to everybody? People who have very low status in a group have a hard time getting resources. So we work hard to create and maintain a certain status. That status is tied to our physiological survival, and insults, therefore, threaten even our sense of food. If I'm insulted, I may lose my status, I may not be able to maintain myself anymore. So we also tend to react very strongly to feelings of being insulted, to feelings of being offended. So that's the point from a conditioned soul. But our philosophy is that everything we have in this world has some reality. Everything has some origin of it. You know, in this world, when I become angry, and I'll say I, you know, when I become angry because I'm hungry or tired and I think someone's insulted me and I start insulting them, which is basically what Nityananda is doing, you know, I'm tired, I'm hungry, I'm whatever, I'm thirsty. And then I perceive somebody's behavior as an insult. And then having perceived their behavior as an insult, I insult them. When I do that, it's completely under illusion, under the modes of material nature. None of my reasons for behaving that way have any basis in reality. And definitely none of my reasons for behaving like that are to grow or nourish my relationships with others and to experience rasa. In fact, when I behave like that, I'm going to damage my relationships, not nourish them. Isn't this correct? No. The times that I've been hungry, thirsty, tired, sick, and therefore overreacted to a situation and insulted other people, there was damage to relationships. And sometimes that damage to relationship is long-term. There are people who, you know, they don't speak to each other for decades because of a particular incident. But there is an origin of these things which actually nourishes love and nourishes relationships. So this is very hard for us to understand, because this kind of behavior is the main thing that destroys relationships in this world. It's up there with probably the top five causes, you know, if somebody wants to do some sort of research. What are the causes of damaging relationships or severing relationships? This kind of jumping to conclusions about someone else's intentions and insulting them has got to be really up there on the list. So we can't even imagine that it can be a source of nourishing relationships. And of course, Rupa Goswami explains all this very nicely in his Bhaktivedanta Sindhu, where he's explaining the Lord's behavior and the behavior of the devotees according to these rasas. And there's a rasa of anger. There is a rasa of anger. There's even a ghastly rasa. And Krishna has a personality called Dhirodhata. So Krishna has four main personality traits. There's Dhirodhata, Dhiraprasanta, Dhiralalita, and Dhirodhata. Dhiraprasanta is God as the supreme gentleman. That's when he's washing the feet at the Rajasuya Yajna, for example. Dhiralalita is God as a supreme fun person, party boy. And Dhirodhata is God as a supreme hero, like when he lifts Govardhana Hill. Dhiralalita is seen when Krishna is stealing the gopis' clothes and playing in Vrindavan. But then there's Dhirodhata. Dhirodhata is God as a supreme bad boy. And you see in this world that all these four types of heroes are attractive. Yes? The tough bad guy is also attractive. Not just the gentleman, not just the righteous hero like Lord Ramachandra, and not just the fun festival party person, but sometimes the bad guy. I mean, we had just Varaha's appearance day, and he was in this also Dhirodhata mood with Hiranyaka. He starts insulting Hiranyaka. Generally, we see Krishna gets in this Dhirodhata mood with demons. Generally. But even among intimates, that can sometimes be there. In fact, how do we know in this world that someone is very intimate with us? So I was at a seminar many years ago, several hundred devotees from all over the world, and it was being organized by a devotee who's from Ireland. So at the end of the seminar, the speakers sat up on the stage, and it was like the farewell time, and at least 200-300 devotees were in the audience. And this devotee who hails from Ireland was speaking about each of the seminar speakers. And usually in that kind of case, you glorify the people. We're thanking this person for being here, and this is seminar and such was very enlivening, right? And then often you give them some kind of a gift in front of everybody, and everybody claps, right? So what this devotee did instead was he insulted everybody. He went down the line of speakers, and he said, "This person doesn't dress very nicely." Seriously. And I was one of the speakers, and I'm sitting on stage. And first of all, I didn't particularly like being insulted in front of 200 or 300 people, especially people that had been kind of in the role of my students. It was really very awkward. But even worse than that, I didn't like sitting up there, listening to him insult these other people. And I'm kind of stuck up there. You know, I'm not going to, like, walk off the stage. And it wasn't a situation where I could protest very easily. So I thought, okay, I'm stuck hearing this insults. And afterwards, I was speaking to him, and a couple other devotees were there. We were taking prasadam, and I said, "Prabhu, why did you insult everybody?" And he said, "Well, in Ireland, that's how we show love." And I said, "Well, in America, that's how we show love too, Prabhu, but privately. Not publicly." Anyway, he never did see my point of view on the issue. But definitely, one of the ways that you communicate that you have a high degree of intimacy with somebody is that you can insult them. Yes? It's one of the markers of intimacy. Just like I was saying something to Kaishori the other day, and I used a strong word. And the next morning, I apologized to everyone, and they said, "Oh, no, that just means your family." That's their mercy, that they saw it like that. But really, that is an indicator. So in the spiritual world, this kind of anger and this kind of insult actually nourishes rasa. It makes it sweeter. And the devotees also sometimes insult the Lord, which from the point of view of people in you know, reverential mood, they can't understand this at all. Now, the cowherd boys, they're insulting Krishna. They're saying, you didn't pick up Govardhan Hill. It was, you know, Madhu Mangal's mantras that made it fly in the sky. And hey, I'm stronger than you. You know, who do you think you are? What to speak of the gopis? They really insult Krishna. I mean, they're doing it regularly. And they're pretty heavy about it, too. And they insult him with all of his other incarnations, also. They say, you know, it's not just this life that you're a cheater. We know who you were in your previous lives. You cheated Bali out of the universe. Now, this has been going on for a long time, this bad behavior of yours. So they're doing like that. And it says that Krishna enjoys these insults of the gopis more than he enjoys the praising of the Vedic hymns. And again, we're also like that. If people are saying, you're wonderful, you're wonderful, you're wonderful, and you're wonderful, and you're wonderful, and you're wonderful. It's nice sometimes to have a good friend who can say, hey, you know, that was a really dumb thing you did. And not even always playfully, you know. Sometimes they say, hey, you know, that was a really dumb thing that you did. And we go, yeah, it was. Prabhupada talks about this king who had his, you know, the jester. Now the kings would have jesters because everybody is always praising them. Prabhupada talks about Gopal Bhan, and the king said to Gopal Bhan, ha! What's the difference between you and a fool? So the king insults Gopal Bhan. Now, if the king insults you, you usually take a position and say, nothing, sir. Nothing, your majesty. You look down and you go, I am a fool. But Gopal Bhan gets out a rope and he measures between himself and the king. And he says, about 3 feet, sir. And the king was enjoying it. Was enjoying this. So we should be very, very careful. We have a personalistic philosophy. Not only do we have a personalistic philosophy, but we have a philosophy of the highest manifestation of personalism, where things are very intimate. And therefore, in that highest manifestation of the Lord's personality, where things are very intimate, are going to be things where the majestic idea of God doesn't fit at all. And if we're going to say, what is the highest manifestation of God? I can really appreciate and read Bhagavatamrita and Gopakumaras and Vaikuntha. The residents of Vaikuntha think that Vishnu is the Supreme Lord and that Krishna is just an incarnation. Whereas we Gaudiyas are saying very strongly, Krishna is the avatari, and Vishnu is an expansion. And sometimes people have argued with me about this. Actually, Narayana, Vishnu is the highest manifestation of God. And I said, well, really, that depends on how you define God. If you define God as the all-majestic, royal, if you only define God as Dhira Shanta and Dhira Danta, then, yeah, Narayana is the highest manifestation of that. But if you define God as Akila Rasamrita Murti, if you define God as the personification of all rasas, then you're going to go to these intimate rasas. And in these intimate rasas, love is nourished by things which destroy love when there's not that intimacy. And the purpose of the Lord's acting in this way, the purpose of the devotees acting in this way, is to deepen the love. And that's what we'll see is going to go on in this lila, that love simply deepens between the Lord and his devotees in various ways. Although it does lead to somebody getting upset. Okay. There was somebody who took it wrongly. Nityananda Prabhu, meanwhile, became very hungry and upset because he had not yet obtained a suitable residence. He began calling Shivananda saying, now it even gets more extreme. Shivananda Sain has not arranged for my residence, he complained, and I am so hungry I could die. Because he has not come, I curse his 3 sons to die. Whoa! When God gets into these rasas, he really gets into them. Whatever Krishna is, he's unlimitedly so. By the way, none of the sons died. Don't worry. Hearing this curse, Shivananda Sen's wife began to cry. So she's the first person here who gets very upset. Just then, Shivananda returned from the toll station. Crying, his wife informed him, Lord Nityananda's cursed our sons to die because his quarters have not been provided. Now, I'm not really sure what her mood was here. But, I mean, I'd cry. Wouldn't you cry?
Yes.
I'd definitely be crying. Shivananda Sen replied, you crazy woman. Boldly, you crazy woman. Why are you needlessly crying? Let my three sons die for all the inconvenience we have caused Nityananda. Who of us would say that? Anybody here would say that? Amazing, the devotees. Devotees are amazing. I mean, this reminds us of the last verse of the Shikshastika. And we say that in many temples, they recite the Shikshastika every morning. You may crush me by your embrace or trample me, but you are my worshipful Lord unconditionally. And as soon as there's a little disturbance, you're not my worshipful Lord anymore. I have nothing to do with you. You know, so how many of us really feel like this? You know, my kids are going to die because my husband was late because he's paying a toll. And you're going to think, that's really unreasonable. What kind of, and why am I worshiping this unreasonable, emotional, out of control God? You know, that's what we would say. We'd say, wait, look, we're taking care of the whole trip for you. One little problem. And my kids are going to die? Aren't you kind of overreacting here? You know, and we'd probably become atheists. And his mood is, Nityananda's happiness is so important. Let my kids die, if that will make him happy. I've inconvenienced him. I'm wrong here. And Lord Brahma says it's this mentality that's the key to entering the kingdom of God, by the way. Tatenukam pam sukshamiksham. When we go through some difficulty, we say, it's my fault. Let me offer more obeisances unto the Lord. And I will tell you personally that I find this the most difficult thing to do. However much people may struggle with, you know, waking up early, following the regular principles, chanting their rounds, eating food only cooked by devotees, and that kind of thing is nothing compared to this. Nothing. That, you know, we feel that we've been punished unfairly. That Krishna is making us suffer unfairly. And therefore we lose our faith. Don't we deal with people like this all the time? I wasn't treated nicely by my local ISKCON management. This happened, this happened, this happened, and I'm so devoted, I've given everything, I'm not going to chant anymore. I'm not going to follow Krishna consciousness anymore. Do we deal with this all the time? And people will say, I'm broken. I'm broken, I can't function. And even if we don't go that far, you know, we can have our little faith crises where we sit in our room and say, Krishna, I don't like you anymore. I don't want anything to do with you anymore. And then we come out smiling and tell everybody that we're okay. You know, we just think, how can you make me suffer like this? How can you make my family suffer like this? And there's one devotee from this area whose daughter was horribly murdered in Vrindavan. It was recently the anniversary of her daughter's death, and she posted something on social media and saying, that was the day my faith died. So that's a typical response. You know, your kids die, you get sick, you lose all your money, you lose your social position or something, you know, to just hate God. But Shivananda Sen's mentality was, he can do anything to me. He can do anything to my family. Whatever he likes, he can do. I consider it nothing. that my offense in not making sure he was taken care of is so great that whatever he does to me in retribution is small. And that is love. But that sounds awfully scary to most of us, doesn't it? That I really have to love to that extent. Now, in this world, we really shouldn't love anyone to that extent, frankly. We'll end up in a, what they call nowadays in modern jargon, an unhealthy relationship. If I love another jiva so much that they can do anything to me for any excuse, and I still give them everything, I probably need some kind of psychological counseling. And I'm probably not going to be a very happy person. But when it comes to God, you can do it. And in fact, you know what? We're all looking for that relationship. We're all looking for a relationship where I can trust that whatever the person I love does to me and for me is loving and for my benefit. Where I can trust that even things done to me which seem very harmful are not so. And where I can say, I am giving you everything unconditionally. And however you treat me in return, I will consider to be a beautiful and wonderful thing. We're looking for a relationship where we can trust somebody that much. And in this world, or anywhere in the material worlds, not only on this planet, with another conditioned jiva, we're never going to find that. Never. We may get in some heady romantic space for a while and think like that. But when we're little children, we think our parents are going to be like that. But we just get disappointed again, 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 again. Tarek and I went out shopping yesterday, and one of the stores, we were playing a song like that. I gave you my heart and you broke it, and so I'm not letting you touch it again. And that's what happens in this world. We think this person is going to be Krishna for me and I can give myself to them wholly. And we get down, we get hurt. And then we say, no, I'm not going to give myself wholly to anybody anymore. And so when we hear about this kind of surrender to Krishna, we become frightened. And we say, wow. Love means if Krishna curses my children to die, it's okay? And I blame myself? We don't realize that God is the self of the self. He's the super self. He's only going to do things that benefit us. We're part of him. There's no question of him doing anything, even whatever appears from our mundane vision. There's nothing he does. God is all good. God is all merciful. And how does Krishna Das Kavya start this chapter? All glories because they are full of mercy. And then he tells this story. All glories to Nityananda, an ocean of mercy. And then he tells this story. So how do we get to this point of Shivananda Singh? Because we really, actually, we want to. We're afraid of it, but we want it. We want it like anything. This is why people buy animals. They're thinking, well, I get unconditionally love my animal. You know, my animal won't break my heart. Isn't it? Of course, you don't really have much of a relationship with the animal. The reason they can't break your heart is there's not much of a relationship there to begin with. It's mostly imagination. But we're looking for that. People do this for their country. Yes? I'll join the military and I'm willing to give my arms and legs for my country. And I'll consider it an honor to do so. Correct? It's my great honor that I've literally given my right arm. I have no right arm. And then you're disappointed. You know, you become a veteran and they don't pay all your bills. And you know, it happens. But we're looking for this. Or people want to give everything to their sports teams. Or they want to give everything to their work. We give everything to this body. We serve our body so nicely. And the body isn't exactly appreciative. You've all noticed that? That no matter how much you serve, your body is not appreciative and insults you? You didn't take care of me nicely.
But I did.
No, you didn't. But this is what we're looking for. So how do we come to that point? Generally, gradually. As we give more and more to the Lord, we gradually realize that. Even if the Lord deals with us in ways that seem to us very outrageous from a mundane perspective, everything is loving and everything is rasa. All right, so this gets worse. It actually gets worse here. So far, Nityananda has called him ill names. He's cursed his son to die. Now, after saying this, Jivananda Sen went to Nityananda Prabhu, who then stood up and kicked him. So here, Jivananda Sen has this mood of total surrender. You can kill my kids if you want. You can kill my kids because you had to wait a few hours for a place to stay and something to eat. And I'm fine with that. With that mood, he approaches Lord Nityananda. And Lord Nityananda's response is to kick him. How does Jivananda Sen respond to this? Very pleased at being kicked. Jivananda Sen quickly arranged for a milkman's house to be the Lord's residence. He had to arrange something very quickly. So that's what he did. He was very pleased. Jivananda Sen touched the lotus feet of Nityananda Prabhu and led him to his residence. After giving the Lord his quarters, Jivananda Sen, being very pleased, spoke as follows. Today you have accepted me as your servant. So again, what he's saying is, we are now intimates. But especially in this mood of master and servant. Because only a master can punish a servant. If you punish someone else who's not in some intimate relationship, it's out of line. Right? If you punish someone, they have to be in a position that they're your servant. I mean, nowadays anybody tries to correct and punish anybody. But that's not proper. He said, you'll properly punish me for my offense. My dear Lord, you're chastising me as your causeless mercy. Who within the three worlds can understand your real character? So he's saying, this is indicative that you've accepted me as a servant. That you're willing to punish me. Come on, you know what it's like. Somebody will do something wrong, and we don't want to say anything to them, because we know we don't have a relationship that will sustain it. So when we can say something to somebody, especially if we can get really, really heavy with them, that means there's a relationship that can sustain it. So Jivananda Sen says, we obviously have a very tight and good relationship. Then he goes on and says, the dust of your lotus feet is not attainable even by Lord Brahma, yet your lotus feet have touched my wretched body. Today, my birth, my family, and my activities have all become successful. Today, I have achieved the fulfillment of religious principles, economic development, satisfaction of the senses, and ultimately, devotional service to Lord Krishna. So any touch from the Lord's lotus feet, even if apparently in anger. I was talking to a devotee the other day who said, everybody says they want to see God, I want to hear him. And reading this pastime, I thought, what about touch him? What about be touched by the Lord? So there, you know, we may think, well, the kind of touch I want Krishna to shake my hand, or I want Krishna to embrace me, I don't want him to kick me. But with the Lord, it's all absolute. Whether he kicks you or whether he hugs you, it's all equally ecstatic. So being kicked by Lord Nityananda filled Jivananda Sen with such ecstatic happiness that he felt that anything he could want by being rich, anything he could want by having the satisfaction of his senses, anything he could want by thinking of himself as a good religious person, and anything he could want in Krishna Bhakti, he had it. He wasn't speaking theoretically. He was experiencing this. He was experiencing, I'm completely satisfied. Wow. I have now the feeling of having the happiest thing I could possibly want. So not only have you accepted me as your servant, but you granted me beyond the universe of everything. When Lord Nityananda heard this, he was very happy. He rose and embraced Jivananda Sen in great love. So this whole behavior of Lord Nityananda was designed to increase their loving relationship and increase their happiness. And that's all that it did. It didn't actually do anything else. It didn't damage their relationship. It wasn't on the platform of ego. Being very much pleased by Nityananda Prabhu's behavior, Shivananda Sen began to arrange residential quarters for all the Vaishnavas headed by Advaitacharya. So obviously they were all much more patient. They waited for him to arrange everything with Nityananda. One of Sri Nityananda Prabhu's characteristics is his contradictory nature. When he becomes angry and kicks someone, it's actually for his benefit. Okay, now we have someone here who didn't see things this way. We have someone who became disturbed, who couldn't understand that what was really happening was that Shivananda Sen and Nityananda were getting into a deeper, more intimate relationship, and that Nityananda was benedicting Shivananda Sen, who is always experiencing unlimited ecstasy, to have his ocean of unlimited ecstasy overflow, such that he feels, you know, now I've achieved everything that anybody could possibly want. That was his subjective emotional experience. But someone didn't see it that way. Shivananda Sen's nephew, Srikanta, the son of his sister, felt offended. And he commented on the matter when his uncle was absent. So when Shivananda Sen wasn't there, so Shivananda Sen's sister's son said to somebody, Nityananda has offended my father. Now, from a mundane point of view, that would be a very reasonable assessment, wouldn't it? Yes? Correct? Am I correct? So now Srikanta is in a disturbed state because he felt that an insult to his uncle was an insult to him. So he's interpreted what happened as an insult to his family, which includes him. And again, we have this thing that we react to, insults. My uncle is well known as one of the associates of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but Lord Nityananda Prabhu asserts his superiority by kicking him. All right, what he's talking about here is status. One of the main triggers for us to become rude, nasty, insolent people, offensive people, is feeling that our status is threatened. You know, if you're looking at hunger, thirst, fatigue as a physiological cause of ill behavior, feeling that our status is being threatened is the main cause psychologically of our ill behavior. Someone asked me in Melbourne, you know, what can I do to stop getting angry at my child when he doesn't follow what I say? And I said, the problem is your source of your anger is status. When your child doesn't respect what you say, you get improperly angry because your status is being threatened. And again, if you look at things from a biological point of view, our status has a lot to do with how much resources we get. How much resources we get has a lot to do with our physiological existence. Yes? So we have a very vested interest from a biological point of view with wanting to maintain our status. We're social beings. And it's one of the main causes of friction between people. You haven't dealt with me with the respect that I'm due. And if you analyze improper dealings between humans, even humans in the Hare Krishna movement, you'll often find that the status is at the heart of it. You know, you didn't say, please accept my obeisances. You didn't call me Prabhu. You know, I'm in charge here, and you're not respecting that I'm in charge. You're arguing with my decision, but I'm the one who's in charge. This kind of thing. And here, also, Srikant is differentiating between Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda. He's saying that my father, Shivananda Sen, is one of Lord Chaitanya's associates. And Lord Nityananda should respect that. He should respect that my father, he's a chief associate, not just some guy. He's a very senior person. Once on Balaram's appearance day, in one temple in India, I offered to help make garlands. And there was some older Indian ladies there, and they didn't like the way I was making the garlands. They had their particular style, which I'd never seen before, how they were putting the garlands together. And the temple president's wife saw that they were critical of how I was making the garlands, and she said, "Don't act like that. She's a Prabhupada disciple." Which made me more upset than their criticism of me. why are you using some kind of status to anything that really bothers you? But that's kind of what Srikant's saying. He's saying, my father has very high status. My father has very high status with Lord Chaitanya. Why is Nityananda not recognizing that? After saying this, Srikanta was only a boy, so this is his excuse. Balaka. That he's not. It was an immature response. So he's excused because of his age. Now, by the way, in general, well, we'll get there again. Srikanta was only a boy, left the group, and traveled on alone to the residence of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So this is the typical response to feeling that we're insulted, isn't it? I'm leaving. And the situation I'm dealing with, that's exactly what happened. Oh, get out. Well, I was leaving anyway. Well, you're fired. I'm already quitting. When Srikant offered obeisances to the Lord, he was still wearing his shirt and coat. Therefore, Govinda told him, my dear Srikant, to first take off these garments. Purport. One is forbidden to enter the deity room or offer anything to the deity while wearing a shirt or a coat. In the tantras, it is said, anyone who offers respect and obeisances to the deity while wearing garments on the upper portion of his body is condemned to be a leper for 7 births. So there are still temples in South India where you're not allowed, the men at least are not allowed to wear upper garments at all. Any charter they put around their waist, the upper portion of their body, as a sign of humility. This is, again, I'm coming before the Lord, and coming before the Lord, I take myself as a servant. As Govinda was warning Srikant, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, don't bother him. Let Srikant do whatever he likes. For he has come here in a distressed state of mind. So several things we can understand from this particular verse. One is what Srikant understood, was that Lord Chaitanya already knew everything that happened. Srikant came here to basically report Nityananda Prabhu to Lord Chaitanya. That's what he was coming to do. He was going ahead. You can understand his thinking. He's going in front of the party. He wants to make sure before Lord Nityananda comes that Lord Chaitanya has been appraised of Lord Nityananda's bad behavior. And then Lord Chaitanya will deal with Lord Nityananda as soon as he gets there. That's his idea. Just like when Krishna ate dirt and Balaram and the other boys go to Mother Yasoda and say, Krishna's eating dirt, Krishna's eating dirt. So they're running ahead and tattletailing on him, as we call it, to get Krishna in trouble. So that's what Srikant's trying to do. He's trying to go to who he perceives as Lord Nityananda's authority and get Lord Nityananda in trouble with Lord Chaitanya. But when Lord Chaitanya says this, he immediately understands Lord Chaitanya already knows everything that happens. But there's another very, very important lesson here for us as devotees. If somebody's distressed, they're excused from what would be normally required by etiquette. Not to take offense at somebody who's distressed. Like I gave the example in the beginning about children. You know, it took me a while to figure that out as a parent and as a teacher, that if a child was behaving uncharacteristically badly, that you don't react to the behavior, you find out what's bothering them, and you deal with that. If it's something out of character. And in a similar way, it would really behoove us in our relationships with other devotees. If somebody is nasty or rude to us or deals with us unfairly, before we immediately jump to defense and criticism of them, to first find out what's going on. First, you know, take the time to find out what's going on. There's a story I tell in my forgiveness seminar. It's a true story about a man who went to a restaurant and the waitress wasn't dealing with him very nicely. She gave him the wrong order and she spilled the drink and he was so angry. This is in America where you tip people. I don't know if you do that here. So he wasn't going to tip her very much. Wasn't going to give her much of a tip. And then he overheard some of the other waitresses talking about how this particular woman's husband had just died 5 days previously and she had a number of minor children at home, so she was continuing to work to support her family. And then he understood her forgetfulness and its clumsiness in a very different way. He understood she's distressed. You follow? So to find out, is somebody distressed? You know, what we tend to do is we have this immediate visceral reaction, especially to insults. You know, which is what Srikanta thought happened. This is immediate reaction. I've been insulted? Well, I'll let you find out how I can insult you back. And if we're intelligent and educated people, then we do it in a very clever way. But we do it. And the other person can understand exactly what we're doing. Right? You know, if we're a low-class, uneducated person, then we just say, "You're a jerk." And if we're a very high-class, educated person, then we say, "Well, speaking learned words, you are mourning for that which is not worthy of grief. Wise people don't lament for the living or the dead." So, you know, we have our different ways of going at people. But instead of doing that, I mean, Krishna could do that because Arjuna said, "You're now my guru, and I give you permission to correct me." But instead of doing that, if we stop and find out what's going on. Did you write this at 11 o'clock at night? Or 2 in the morning? What's going on in your life? What's going about you? Instead of just reacting. When we react, what did Gandhi say? An eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. And we go on like this. And this is, you know, Krishna brings good out of it. Krishna brought good out of Parikshit and Sringi. He brings good out of it. But Prabhupada said the tit for tat was silly. Parikshit is so sure that he was offended, so he offends Shamakarisi. And then Sringi is so sure that Parikshit was the offender, so he goes way overboard and curses Maharaj Parikshit to die. Prabhupada said this tit for tat is silly. So rather than descending to that level of behavior, if we can stop and think, you know, if somebody's acting like this, maybe there's something going on in their life. Maybe I can look at that first. And if it's not the kind of situation where I can ask somebody, then I can even assume that. I can think, maybe this person's really had a hard day. Maybe there's all kinds of other things that went on this day, and what happened with me was the last straw. Maybe there's something else. Maybe they're sick. Maybe they're in pain. Maybe they just got some terrible news. When people overreact, now somebody overreacts all the time, that's another thing. But if people overreact and if people seem to be doing something out of character or out of what we normally expect people to do, that's the kind of thing to ask. So this is what Lord Chaitanya's response. Oh, he's upset. It's all right. People forget about etiquette when they're upset. He's not held accountable for it. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu inquired from Srikant about all the Vaishnavas, and the boy informed the Lord about them, naming them one after another. When Srikant heard the Lord say he is distressed, he could understand that the Lord is omniscient. As he described the Vaishnavas, therefore, he did not mention Lord Nityananda's kicking Shivananda Singh. So he let it go. He said the Lord already knows about this, and he was peaceful. And this is also how we can deal in our lives. That Krishna knows. He knows. And he's dealing with things. You know, then Srikanta had trust. Everything's okay. Because obviously he had a lot of faith in Lord Chaitanya. So he thought, he knows. And everything's under control. Everything's okay. Now, it's interesting that we don't know whether or not Srikanta ever came to understand what was going on. He may or he may not. We don't know. It's not explained in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Did he come to understand that this was a display of rasa going on? But he came to the point of trust. And the fact is, we will not always understand everything. This was something between Lord Nityananda and Shivananda Singh primarily. And maybe Srikanta wasn't going to be privy to their particular emotions and their particular mood. But he came to the point that he trusted it's all good. It's all merciful. It's under control. And we need to have this kind of trust with Krishna also, at least for the things that happened in our own lives, that, you know, I'm not always going to understand everything about Krishna. To come to the point where you say, in order for me to be okay with things, I have to fully understand them. No, we don't. That we can love Krishna without fully understanding why he does everything that he does. He may not explain everything to us. But we trust his intentions, and we trust his omniscience. And again, we can't do that with another jiva. If we think God is a person like another conditioned jiva, we'll find this impossible. But if we understand that he's omniscient and he's all-pervading, then we can actually we can have that kind of trust, which tends to develop very gradually. So this chapter goes on to be all kinds of wonderful and ecstatic pastimes, but as it is already 9 o'clock, we will end here. Yes?
How do you find out what's going on from somebody who is like a family member, your wife, your teenage children, who there is a certain emotional barrier maybe there? You know, in families, you don't trust. You lose trust.
Mm.
So how do you find out from them, especially teenagers, when, you know, certain things are going on, certain behaviors, and you want to find out what's...
Well, you really talked about it yourself. There has to be a relationship of trust established. So if that relationship is damaged, then you have to build on that relationship of trust, because people will not tell you what's really bothering them if they don't trust you, because as soon as they tell you that, then they become vulnerable. So if people don't feel safe, then they'll just attack somebody instead of talking about what's really bothering them. I mean, there's just mundane things that you can do in your relationship with others to try to bring a relationship from the mode of ignorance to the mode of passion or up to the mode of goodness. There's ways of communication that can develop trust in a relationship. We need to develop trust. If people can't be honest with each other, then when they're actually upset about something else, they'll lash out and attack somebody. It's quite common. And they don't want to say what their real issue is, because then they have to talk about their feelings and they have to talk about their needs and they become vulnerable. So therefore, it behooves us to establish relationships of love and trust. And again, there's a lot of, you can get a lot of guidance for this even on the mundane level, how to establish loving and trusting relationships. That's beyond the scope of what I would talk about in the next like 30 seconds. It's not a 30-second thing. But there's a lot of books, there's a lot of courses, there's a lot of guidance as to how to have relationships of love and trust. Remembering that other people are not God. I can never trust somebody like I trust God, and no one should ever be asked to trust me like I'm God. I'm not trustworthy like God. I'm not. And nor is anyone else. Any other jiva would speak of a conditioned jiva. So that has to be kept in mind. It's not going to be absolute. It's a relative amount of trust. We can have absolute love for others if we first have absolute love for Krishna. But absolute trust? Not a conditioned soul. Can't. Conditioned soul means that they're not completely trustworthy. That's what it means. That's the definition of a conditioned soul. Yes?
When I was younger, they used to read Chaitanya Charitamrita in the morning before Srila Bhagavatam, and that's the only time I've ever really heard it. Since then I haven't read it or heard it.
Oh.
And I was just thinking recently, because I read Bhagavatam, mm-hmm. and I was just thinking recently that I might start reading Chaitanya Charitamrita, because I want to learn. These are my deities and I don't know very much.
That would be lovely. And that would be a lovely thing to do.
Well, my question to you was, because your class was just incredible, and I don't think that I could read it and get those kinds of understandings just reading it on my own. So I just wondered whether you thought it was recommended or not.
There's certainly a lot of recorded online classes on the Chaitanya Charitamrita, and there may even be, you know, online courses that you can sign up for. You know, I think if you're interested in that, you do some research and see if there's people offering interactive online courses in Chaitanya Charitamrita. My guess is there is somebody doing that in English in the Hare Krishna world. At the very least, you could go to a place like ISKCON Desire Tree and find classes in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. I mean, we have some temples, and maybe that'll happen here at some point in the temple development when those sort of classes are going on. They wouldn't go on in the morning usually, but where they would go on as part of the temple. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you look at. So we have certain places in the world that are really centers of Shastric study, and where there's classes in all of Prabhupada's books, and people, they're getting Bhakti Shastri and Bhakti Vaibhava degrees and things like that. That's very attractive for the devotees. Depends on the mood of the community also. So what I've seen as I travel is some communities are, the people in that community, for whatever reason, are naturally study people, and some communities are not. you know, we're traveling selling mana shiksha. So, you know, I've gone to one community where 100 books wasn't enough to meet the demand, and you drive 2 hours away and you only sell 4. Even though the same number of people come to the program. So it's does that come from the leaders of the temple, or does that come from the mood of that particular place? I don't know. But you do see that certain places there's a real mood of Shastric study, and certain places there are not. And exactly where that comes from, I really don't know. But I've certainly noticed it as I travel. But you could also start a little Chaitanya Charitamrita study group yourself, or find somebody who, you know, find some group of people who'd like to study and get together, like once a week or something like that. That's another alternative. I'm sure there's some people in the area who'd be interested. Thank you. That was very nice. Yes?
I don't understand what you said before. You can't have a relationship with animals. My entire life, I've always had animals.
I didn't say you can't have a relationship with animals. I didn't say that. I said the relationship is not, it's not on as deep a level as you may think it is. So if you have a relationship with an animal and you're feeling this animal is giving me unconditional love, that's probably not the case. It may look like that, but it's probably not the case. So there may be some instances where that's the case, but generally it's not. The soul in the animal body is not usually developed enough in consciousness. They're usually too covered by the material modes of nature to be able to get to that point of unconditional love. So it may look like that, because the animal's not really capable of saying to you, you know, what they're thinking or really understanding at that level. Of course you can have a relationship. I've had relationships with animals. Not that you can't have relationships with animals, of course you can. And you can have very loving relationships with animals. Even with another human, unless those humans are on the point of full self-realization, they don't have a relationship of unconditional love. People can talk about it all they want, but it's just simply not true. As long as I'm identifying with this body and mind, and as long as I think that my existence is dependent on the body and mind, I cannot be unconditional in my love. My desire for self-preservation is sometimes going to trump my love. It just will. It's only when I realize that I'm a soul, that I can't be hurt, and that there's nothing that can threaten me at all, that I can love unconditionally. Otherwise, there's a condition. I'm only going to love up to the point where I feel totally threatened. Now, some people go really far in that. I mean, there are people who literally sacrifice their life for someone or something. So there are people who go to a very high level of unconditional love. But as long as there's some sense that my identity is in this fragile thing that I'm walking around in, then I have this, you know, I've got to protect this thing. And if I give to you such that this body and this mind is threatened, I can't. It's very difficult. So animals, generally speaking, are also thinking that they're that body. So for them to be able to give unconditional love, even a not developed human can't do it. And the animals are less developed in consciousness, so that's not what they're doing. It may look like that to us as we anthropomorphize them, but that's not what's happening. They do have a relationship, and they certainly have a relationship. I mean, animals can have a deep relationship of gratitude and loyalty and affection. And definitely. They're souls. They're souls. Why not? They ultimately have that relationship with God just as we do, so they have that capacity. Occasionally, an animal, by the grace of the Lord, may come to a liberated platform. But that's unusual. Much more unusual than for a human. So, of course, we have a relationship. But what's the... There's a limit on the extent to which we can have an actual relationship. As long as the entity is covered. Does that make sense? understandable. Many people feel that way. But the reason for that is that they're more covered. Just like that devotee was talking about teenagers. You know, when you have a little tiny baby, a little baby human, and you know, one of the sweetest things with little baby humans is when you put them on your chest when they're sleeping, and you're rocking in a rocking chair, and the little baby is their chest is on your chest, and you're just it's an incredible experience. But the baby's not in a position, because they're covered, that they're really exhibiting their own will. You know, and they get a little older, and then you see, wait a minute, you know, where was that relationship? That relationship that seemed to be of utter trust and utter oneness and utter unconditional love. Where is it now that they're 13 or even 3? So it appeared to be there when they were so covered that they couldn't exhibit it. It wasn't actually there. It gives us some idea of the ultimate relationship. So with animals, it's like that. They're kind of like human children. And, you know, you can feel this oneness of love and this trust and this. But that's just because they're covered. It's not totally real. All relationships on the platform of material conditioning are more or less an illusion. And it doesn't matter whether that relationship is human to tree or tree to tree or human to insect or human to human or human to demigod. When we're not awake to our real identity, then our relationships are through a false identity, and they're not fully real. They may look like that to us, but they're not. And sometimes when a being is more covered, it's easy to think that my relationship with them is deeper. I mean, what's actually a deeper relationship with a little baby that trusts you completely because they have to? They trust you enough to just fall asleep on your shoulder and let you take them anywhere. Or if you actually had a trusting relationship with a 16-year-old, what's really a deeper relationship? You know, is the baby knowing you and choosing to trust you to that extent out of volition? Not really. So if a 16-year-old chooses to trust you to that extent, it's a lot more meaningful. Although it may feel deeper to have the little baby on your chest. Unless we come to the platform of knowing who we are, I can't have a relationship with you if I don't know who is the I and who is the you. So it's a question of more or less and of different flavors. Okay, I should end here. It's late. I hope you're happy with that. At least somewhat. Nityananda Prabhu ki jai.